Welcome to Based AF. I'm sociologist Ashley Frawley. This week, I interviewed Debbie Hayton, author of Transsexual Apostate, My Journey Back to Reality. The conversation made me realize that maybe the real bigots are those who can't accept that a man might wish to live as a woman, and maybe that's okay. They have to pretend like nothing's really happened, that you were really a woman all along, and in the process have to redefine what it means to be a woman in ways that don't really make sense. But you decide. Can you give me a sense of what you were hoping readers would get from this book?
Yeah, I wanted to get across the idea of why middle-aged men transition. It's such a bizarre thing to do. And it's something I did 12 years ago without ever really understanding what I was doing. So after working out what was actually behind this, I wanted to write the book for two things. One, to tell my story. But secondly, to try and help other people work through the same issues, because I don't think it's as uncommon as people imagine it to be.
So what about the experience do you think was not as uncommon as people imagine?
Well, I think it comes down to male sexuality, which can be strong, it can be varied, it can be fixated on a number of things can male sexuality. In my case, it was fixated on my own body. You know, men can be attracted to anything. Why not their own bodies, for goodness sake? But when, as an heterosexual male, so I'm naturally attracted to stereotypically female bodies, when that focus of attraction is my own body, then it becomes a circle that can't be squared. And instinct is that I'm attracted to this body, but it's not the body I want to be attracted to. So solution was to transition this body, to make it look more feminine, to make it be more attractive to me, to make me feel that I was more attractive as a person to do this. Now, I don't think those thoughts and those struggles which some men have is as uncommon as we imagine it to be, because not everybody transitions, certainly not in that position. And I think some people will just struggle with this for life. And what's been encouraging after publishing the book is the number of private messages I've had from middle-aged men who are telling me that, thank you for publishing this book. I've read it, and now I think I understand myself.
What's really interesting to me is that after sort of thinking about this for a long time, but writing about it and interviewing about it for the last month or so, you know, that I've sort of done this deep dive and I've talked to a few different people, is this kind of startling lack of curiosity about what feeds into transition. It's sort of like the question that shouldn't be asked, or it comes down to like, well, I just had this deep feeling and maybe there's a little bit of a story about one's childhood and so on. But the nitty-gritty of sort of what leads someone to transition isn't talked about that much. And when I talked to a trans activist, Robin Moira White, who you might be familiar with, I think you've appeared on some shows, at least consecutively, if not together. And what was interesting is that I brought up the idea of autogynephilia, and she sort of brushed it off saying, well, I assume there are these people like that. And there was this kind of question, like, is it really trans? You know, she didn't necessarily deny that it was trans, but it was something that was sort of brushed off. And then others, when we talked about it on Sublation Media, another channel where I do these podcasts, you know, people were saying, well, that's transphobic, even to kind of bring it up. But you're a trans woman yourself, and you're saying that this is part of your experience. Why do you think it needs to be minimized to such an extent?
Well, I think there's two things in what you said there. One is, what is the cause of transsexualism? We've invented this concept called gender identity. There is no need for gender identity. I've been able to explain my own transition without it. So let's just park that to one side for a moment. But then there's also the solution, the treatment, this idea that we can transform our bodies to be more acceptable to us, to be more attractive to us, that bodies that we can be more comfortable with. So it's those two things. There's gender identity on one side, and there's the treatment at the other side. Now, my view is the treatment, it's the treatment which has driven the demand for it. We all want to look attractive. We all want to feel that we're attractive to other people. We all want to feel we're attractive to ourselves. And if there's some treatment which is available, which can actually do that and help us become more comfortable with our own bodies, then people are going to want that treatment. And it's going to become an imperative. It's probably in the same way that other people crave some plastic surgery to make their bodies more attractive to themselves. But this I think is also tied in with our sexuality. So as a result of our sexuality, which I said before, there's this demand for this treatment. But in doing so, especially if we're talking about men, I can't speak for women, I'm not a woman, but if we speak for men, our sexuality is not something we care to admit to ourselves, and certainly not to other people. And if we can have a workaround to invent gender identity, this idea that we've been born in the wrong body, so therefore we must have the treatment, that's enticing, is that? People like that idea. The alternative, which is to say, this is an unusual sexuality, and I'm sexually attracted to my own body, so if I transition this treatment, which is available, if I get this treatment, then my body is more attractive to me. That's less, that's not what we're wanting to be admitting. I guess it's far easier to find sympathy for having been born in the wrong body than being a man with an unusual sexuality. So I can understand why other male transsexuals like to marginalize autogynephilia and like to pretend that it's not there. It's hard to admit to yourself that you really are.
So I'm going to come back to that question of sort of, you know, older men transitioning and the reasons why. But what I find very interesting is that there is also a claim that circulates in society at the moment that male sexuality is really beyond the pale in our culture, that it's something that doesn't receive a lot of cultural affirmation. A part of me sees this and is sympathetic to it. On the other hand, the gender critical feminists, they really, really have a problem with this. So it's sort of pushed to one side the fact that this could be have something to do with male sexuality by trans activists. And gender critical feminists are not having any of that. They are constantly pulling up internet forums.
Welcome back to Listen to Trans People, where that's all we do, part 23. Girl horny. They told me progesterone would bring my libido back in force, and boy did it. What I wasn't expecting was how different girl horny is. It's everywhere, all the time. Never goes away. I can't just wait out girl horny. I just have to sit with it, feeling a weird emptiness between my legs that I can't do anything about. I wish someone would just run a train on me. I can't even masturbate it away. My girl horny makes me feel like I'm a bitch in heat. Like I'll start wanting to throw my up in the air and hope someone. It's a nice bunch of changes.
And it's her reading posts on Reddit of men who are quite clearly like have a sexual thrill about transitioning. And she's looking at the camera like this. And so they don't want to. It goes further because they don't want to affirm as a woman what is a man's sexuality. If we kind of were more open about the fact that this is just a different kind of sexuality, do you think we could have a more open conversation about that and maybe work through some of the problems that gender critical feminists are bringing up? Or is this just a stalemate?
I think we're a long way back from being able to talk about this openly and confidently with each other. This condition, which I've been talking about, autogynephilia is the name which was given to it by Ray Blanchard in 1989, I think. So it's an old idea that I'm talking about. But autogynephilia is a male's propensity to be sexually attracted to the thought of himself as a woman. That's the theory. In practice, it drives people to transition, as I've done myself. Now, As an autogynephilic male, what I'm actually doing is I'm actually transforming my body to be more attractive to myself. This is I guess, how I want my ideal woman to look like, I guess. This is hard, really, to explain. But we transform our bodies to be attractive to ourselves. Now, when you look at autogynephilic males, yes, those communities on Reddit, people who post those pictures themselves online, what you're seeing is those men's attempts to paint that perfect woman onto their own bodies. Now, I don't think that autogynephilic males are anything unusual. I just think we're normal males. And when you look at autogynephilic males, what we do with our bodies is typical, I think, of what other men will project onto women's bodies, how they would like their women to present to them. So when we look at autogynephilic males, we're looking at male sexuality, what is usually plausibly denied, in fact. So men will deny their own thoughts quite often because their own thoughts are probably not acceptable to the women that they're in relationships with, possibly not even acceptable to themselves. So they keep those thoughts buried. They deny them. Whereas in autogynephilic males, we have our bodies as a canvas. We paint those thoughts onto our bodies. So by talking about autogynephilia and by talking about myself, what I'm doing is I'm shining a light onto male sexuality. And that's something which people don't like me doing. Other autogynephilic males want to deny their autogynephilia. I guess other men are not too keen on having that light shone onto male sexuality. And I think women would prefer to deny it than accept what men are actually like. Men are not women with a penis. We're very different in lots of ways. And I can't know those differences any more than you can, because I can only know my own experience and you can only know your experience. But what I observe is that men and women are very, very different. And I do wonder if some gender critical feminists are not happy about that distinction too much. So by being public about autogynephilia, I am shining a light onto what people don't like being exposed. And in some ways, I'm also trying to explain the rules of the game that we all play in life. You know, heterosexual adults play with each other. And the rules of the game, we all know them, I think, but nobody likes them to be explained.
In case anyone has managed to avoid the ongoing controversy about what Debbie is talking about here, she's referring to a study by Ray Blanchard published in 1989 and which subsequently circulated online as an explanation for male-to-female transition. At least up until about a decade ago, papers were still saying that no one disputes autogynephilia exists and might be one reason men transition, but it's not the only nor even main reason. However, for the past few years, while some researchers still support the theory, it tends to be referred to as controversial or sometimes widely discredited. How? Trans and bisexual activist and writer Julia Serrano, writing in the Sociological Review monograph, summarizes 7 prominent criticisms, including the diversity of trans women beyond the subtypes Blanchard specified, Blanchard's own research showing many male-to-females or MTFs who were attracted to women didn't engage in female or feminine embodiment fantasies, while many who were attracted to men did. And many, if not most, MTFs recalled the desire to transition before experiencing related fantasies, which Serrano thinks renders autogynephilia impossible as a cause. Moreover, for many, these fantasies faded away after transition. Blanchard also tended to dismiss exceptions to the theory and lacked experimental controls. For instance, he didn't administer his autogynephilia survey to women. Serrano points to follow-up studies which showed that embodiment fantasies are not exclusive to trans women and that male clothing can have sexual connotations for gay and bisexual individuals too. How does Serrano account for the prevalence of female embodiment fantasies among many male-to-females? People who are attracted to female attributes will find those same attributes sexually attractive in relation to their own bodies. The prevalence of these fantasies comes down to the fact that many individuals will have passed through an earlier and concealed cross-dressing phase because of the taboo that society places on the expression of femininity among men. their awakening sexuality, this taboo, and other cultural phenomena combine to make this a highly sexualized experience. But that doesn't mean that it's the cause of these people's trans identities, Serrano argues. Now, Debbie has stated that what she describes of her own experience doesn't account for everything and everyone, but that it does account for many experiences, and more than people are willing to admit. Hayton quotes bioethicist Alice Dreger to explain, quote, "To understand the vehemence of the backlash, you have to understand one more thing. There's a critical difference between autogynephilia and most other sexual orientations. Most other orientations aren't erotically disrupted simply by being labeled. When you call a typical gay man homosexual, you're not disturbing his sexual hopes and desires. By contrast, autogynephilia is perhaps best understood as a love that would really rather we didn't speak its name. The ultimate eroticism of autogynephilia lies in the idea of really becoming or being a woman, not in being a natal male who desires to be a woman." End quote. Hayton continues, "So, essentially, my autogynephilia fueled the need to deny my autogynephilia, and the stronger those feelings became, the greater was the need to deny them. The mere mention of the word could trigger another short circuit, and this one generated feedback of the type that causes shrieks and piercing whistles, but not in audio equipment. This cacophony ripped through my very psyche. The truth stared me in the face. If I was not autogynephilic, why was I so troubled? The same could be said for Conway and all the other transsexuals who denounced Bailey's book, and then Dreger's analysis of it, but it didn't stop there. Autogynephilia ignites fury and fierce denial not only in transsexuals, but also in their proxies. Allies might not be torn apart personally by autogynephilia, but few, I suspect, would want to defend this particular form of male sexuality." Now, I mentioned before that I wanted to come back to this idea that there are different sorts of reasons why people might transition. So do you think that there are any other kinds of reasons why people transition? And does that play into the public? Should that play into the public conversation more?
Yes, there are different reasons why people transition, and certainly between the sexes. I come back to gender identity. Gender identity was created as an unfalsifiable and unprovable concept to explain things away, to gloss over what was really happening, to stamp out curiosity. Take away gender identity, and what you have left is this need to transition, this insatiable need to transition. And what curious medics, curious scientists should be doing is saying, what are these reasons? Now, autogynephilia is one reason, but there's others, as you've suggested. Another one in homosexual males can be to make themselves attractive to a wider group of men. So that's a completely different reason for transitioning. I transition to make my body more attractive to me. Homosexual transsexuals will transition to make their body more attractive to men. And talking to homosexual transsexuals, our experience is totally different as well. What I recount in my book, Transsexual Apostate, all those years of shame, homosexual transsexuals, or the ones I've spoken to, just don't feel that at all. That one friend told me that they had transitioned. By the time they transitioned, everybody thought they'd transitioned already. I think I was told that, everybody thought I was a girl, so I might as well just go along with it, which is totally different to my experience. And then there's the other sex. There's the female sex. And to say that there is any link between men who would like to be women for reasons known only to themselves and women who, really, what I observe is don't want to be women, to say that those are same condition, fueled by the same mismatch of gender identity, is just explaining away different people's issues and different people's conditions. So I think there's probably a number of reasons for transitioning or feeling that you should transition, identifying as trans perhaps, and to just claim that there is one reason. This mismatch of gender identity, whatever gender identity is an appalling lack of curiosity in what is, I think, really interesting conditions that we should be investigating and we should be talking about.
Yeah, and this puts me into some dangerous territory, because For me, that's why I'm a sociologist. I am obsessed with the reasons that people give for things. I find that to be the most fascinating part of the human experience. And part of the reason why I have a distaste for some strains of psychology is that it tends to be like, oh, well, I don't know. It's just the way human brains are. Isn't that funny? But then you're not listening to the reasons that people are giving and the stories that they're telling and the way that they construct narratives of their lives, which is the stuff of being human. So the moment someone says hands off, I'm like, I want to know. I really want to know. I actually have a friend who was a gay male and transitioned for the reason that you said. And I found his whole story to be very interesting. And I had a ton of empathy and sympathy for him. And like the way that we talked to each other when he was gay and now that he presents as a woman, are the exact same kind of conversations, and he's going through the same stuff that I go through, you know, dealing with men's shit. So, you know, I'm like, welcome to the sisterhood. But the problem is that I think a lot of the gender critical feminists, they really have a problem with, and they're afraid of, the other type of trans person. And this is why they will not accept that it doesn't exist, because they're intensely fearful of autogynephilic men. And they are fearful of being forced to play this game with somebody publicly where they have to affirm them. And if they don't, there are consequences, and that this is quite gratifying to the man. So an obvious example of this is Jessica Yanov. And it's an extreme example, and I think most people are not like this, but he very clearly was very misogynistic, anti-immigrant, and he used a trans identity and the fact that people didn't quite know what to do with it to get access to children, but also to, you know, punish immigrant women. You know, as soon as they refused to wax his testicles, they were like, I'll see you in court kind of thing. And so people are really, really fearful of that. And there's also a longstanding trope or motif of urban legends of the sick old lady. And the sick old lady, you might hear this in kind of stories about the sick old lady who asks for help in the shopping center and, oh, can you please give me a ride somewhere? And it turns out that it's a murderer, an axe murderer in an old lady's disguise. And this goes back really far in our culture, like, you know, the big bad wolf disguises himself as granny, sick in bed. And so there is this deep, deep rooted fear of a man dressed as a woman, a wolf in sheep's clothing. Do you think that that's like, do you think there's some substance to that? Do you think that's something we should or can get over? What's the solution to that, if any?
Well, I think looking at the Red Riding Hood story, that is so old, is that story. We're talking about issues that go back way in time. This is not new. These issues about what is a man and what is a woman go way back. And the center of all this disputes and all the problems that we're seeing here, I think, is the meaning of the words man and woman. And women who feel that they can't call a man when they know he's a man, to call that out as a man and to be condemned, criticized, and actually brought before the courts for doing that, I think it's dreadful. I think it's awful that we've ever got to this point. And somebody like Yanni was given not just equal rights to everybody else, but special rights almost. And I think that's unhelpful. I think to say to trans people that you need extra rights, you need special rights, I think is unhelpful to us, and it's been unhelpful to everybody else. Sure, say if you wish to present yourself in a way more typical of the opposite sex, you shouldn't be sacked for that. You shouldn't be denied the provision of goods and services for that. I think that's fine, but we seem to have overreached that massively to where trans people can claim extra rights. The right not to be criticized, the right not to be said no to, I think is unhelpful and unhealthy. But going back to what I was saying there about the meanings of the words man and woman, I think there's something here which everybody's been missing. And this is one of the key chapters in my book. And it follows the chapter on autogynephilia, which we've been talking about. And it's this idea of perception. Because it seems to me that the dispute has been over the words man and woman. Everybody is worried that those words are going to be redefined against their interests. So gender critical feminists are worried that the word woman is going to be redefined to encompass any man who says that he's a woman just because he wants to do that, even though he may not have made any changes to his body at all. And we've seen some of those people. And we've seen stories where those people have interacted. Perhaps the We Spa stories is a case in point. Then there are transsexuals who may have transitioned some years ago, are worried that the word woman is going to be set in stone as adult human female, which counts them out of it. And where does that leave them? So they're worried about this. Whereas I think both sides have been asking the question, what is a woman and what is a man? We mustn't forget that. Sometimes men get left out of this. So what is a woman and what is a man? But rather than trying to define what those words mean, they've been saying what they think those words ought to mean. So, and this is controversial, on the transgender activism side, they've been saying that the words man and woman ought to refer to gender identity, ought to refer to how somebody feels about themselves. On the gender critical female side, they've been saying that people have said that those words ought to mean adult human female and adult human male. And yeah, I have a lot of sympathy for that, because that is the root of these words. But the question that nobody's been asking is, what do people mean when they use those words, men and women? That's what's interesting, because I don't think people mean adult human female and adult human male when they use those words, because we've been using those words for, 1,000 years. And their predecessor words we've been using probably for tens or hundreds of thousands of years. And we only understood what biological sex has meant in the last couple of hundred or so. So those meanings of the words man and woman go back way, 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 way back in our evolutionary history. And they're almost baked into us. When we use the word man and woman, what we're doing is we're sharing an experience that we all understand when we look at other people. So we look at another person and say, that is a woman and that is a man. Now, those terms have got meaning because they're tied into, they're rooted in biological sex. But the interesting thing is, if somebody transitions in one direction and passes well enough to tip the balance in somebody else's head, so they're routinely referred to as a woman. And that's the experience I find in real life, away from the internet, where everybody's known for who they are and their background. If I go to the grocery store or put fuel in my car and I go pay for that, people assume that I'm a woman, and they would refer to me as a woman, and it's easier just to go along with that. In the same way that women who transition to become female to male transsexuals go the other direction, they're routinely referred to as men, and what I've observed is that perception is what really matters in these situations. Now, that's liberating to me, because whatever the law says, whatever policy says, people will inevitably and ultimately defer to their gut instinct. And I think that it should give everybody a little bit more confidence from what we've got at the moment. Those words, men and women, can't be redefined, because they're baked into us. Those concepts of man and woman are actually, they're rooted in us. We know the difference between men and women. It's a gut instinct. And it's not just something that human beings can do. Other species can do. Insects, for example, know the difference between the male and the female of their kind without knowing anything about biological sex. But we seem to have forgotten that. Oh, well, nobody's been asking that question. Nobody's been pointing that out, which is one of the reasons I tried to get across this in the book and make such a point of it, because I think it should give people a lot more confidence just to remember that as human beings, we tend to take each other as we find each other.
So this is a position that I have a lot of sympathy for, and I've seen it articulated a few times. which is, you know, for some intents and purposes in society, we are required to treat people as their biological sex. So in sport, for instance, we treat people as their biological sex. When you go to the gynecologist, you're treated as your biological sex. When you, you know, you're looking at health risks, all of that stuff matters. In day-to-day life, if somebody wishes to present as the opposite sex, whatever their culture perceives as the opposite sex, and to be accepted as that, I think that should be accepted. And I think that we were going a long way towards accepting that, actually, before we had to accept that something literal had happened, that when you present as the opposite sex, you truly are something, a subset of that sex or something like that. It's kind of unclear exactly what was going on with the talk of sort of gender identity being, you know, a stand-in for sex. And people are quite wishy-washy with it as well, because sometimes like, oh yeah, no, it's a basic thing. Sex is different than gender, something that I always taught as a sociologist. But then people say, no one ever said, you know, or it's, oh no, but gender is actually more important than sex. And really what we're talking about is gender, because we're really talking about a presentation in everyday life. So that's really what should matter. But, it, you know, there are some situations in which it matters and some situations in which it doesn't. I think for the vast majority of people, they're concerned about the situations in which it doesn't, in which they simply wish to pass. But first of all, there's an issue with that, because what if you don't pass? So what if you aren't clocked as the sex you wish to present as? What then? It seems to sort of invite and necessitate a kind of medicalization. You kind of have to go through procedures. You have to significantly modify yourself. Isn't that a kind of injustice?
Well, it's this is what is. This is the truth. This is reality. And to try and pretend that real life doesn't exist is a lie. I think sometimes life is unkind. Sometimes reality is unkind, and we just need to accept that. Somebody, for example, who has had this is a different case. Somebody who suffers perhaps facial disfigurement, they've suffered serious burns, for example, will have plastic surgery to reconstruct their face. And that's important, because how we actually view other people as attractive or not affects how we relate to them. Now, if that wasn't the case, people wouldn't necessarily need to have, you know, invasive reconstruction surgery. But people do, because that reflects the reality of human interactions. We interact with each other because we've got bodies, and those bodies matter. So in the case of trans people, we transition, and some of us have to work, some people work really hard on that. Some people can't do it. Some people just can't get to the point when they are routinely perceived as the opposite sex. And in that case, then it's distressing for those people, but we can't deny reality. And this is the situation we find ourselves in. Bodies matter, and how those bodies present matter. Otherwise, people wouldn't worry so much about their appearance, but people do. You know, people put lots and lots of effort into their appearance because they know that matters. Going back to, incidentally, what you were saying about gender and sex, I think we took a wrong turn a few years back on that. I think biological sex is real, and you're quite right when you said in sport, biological sex matters. In the same way, it matters whether people have taken performance-enhancing drugs. That matters. And male puberty is, which I went through, is equivalent to a performance-enhancing drug. So male transsexuals need to stay well out of women's sport. Then talk about this word gender. What does it actually mean? It's almost been conflated to this inner feeling, this inner essence, this being inside us. And I think that's unhelpful, to actually label thoughts and feelings as gender. What matters is how other people perceive us. That matters. And that comes down to how we present ourselves and how we relate to other people and how we interact with other people, not how we feel about ourselves. So I think the language has got confused, as well as everything else.
And in addition, how we've been socialized, you know, so that's the other thing, too, is that I regret massive aspects of my own socialization where I recognize that I have been socialized to be meek and to not be assertive and to think that I'm always the problem in the situation and I should shut up, you know, this sort of thing, that I should say yes to men. I should be accommodating and if you're not that, you get sanctioned, you know. So if you get catcalled and or if you get hit on and you're like, no, thank you. Well, I didn't like you anyway, you bitch, you ugly bitch, you know, like they'll come at you if you're not nice. So you learn from a very young age to always be nice, always be accommodating. And one thing I've noticed, I'm like, with some of the displays that you see on the internet is that, you know, that a lot of men have not been, socialized in the same way, but boy, do they expect women to be nice. Anyways, the other thing too is, passing and so on. So this was just basic sociology that I used to teach before this became so politicized. So we, you know, there are very famous sociological studies of like the process of transing and like what the steps that people go through and how much work and effort goes into passing. But there's also a huge movement, particularly it seems to me among younger people, maybe it's an internet thing, I don't know, about sort of breaking down gender norms, not wanting to pass. So there's like, you know, you'll see TikTok videos of a man with a beard, but also wearing makeup and feminine clothing. And like, you know, you don't like know what I am and that's your problem. You know, I'm going to be a woman with a beard and, you know, you need to just recognize that it's your bigotry and this sort of thing. And people are like, don't quite know what to do with that. But that's the point. The point is to subvert the comfort of these sort of binary gender roles. And I think the sort of traditional transsexualism that you're talking about and that might be sort of favored by the old guard doesn't know what to do with that. I don't know what to do with that. Have you seen that? Do you have thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think you picked up on it here on a wider issue. The old school transsexuals, as it's sometimes called, who lived their lives in real life, needed to transition or else it wasn't going to work. And they needed to put a lot of effort into that transition in order to pass as the opposite sex or to do enough so that they tipped the balance in other people's minds. But that's when you live your life in reality, in three dimensions. If you're living your life on social media, where your representation to the world is an avatar, which has possibly been photoshopped beyond recognition, if it was you to begin with, and the words that you write and everything you actually present is a two-dimensional image, which has been, gone through who knows how many filters. It's no longer you that's going across. Now, in real life, there are two sexes because in real life we reproduce and form the next generation. That's kind of important, is that? Whereas online, there's no need for two sexes online. There's no need for any categories at all online. We can just be ourselves. We can try and form new categories. Now, young people have always tried to kick back against the establishment, or they have in my experience anyway. But to go online and to actually recreate yourself online gives you freedom to do things which previous generations never had. And to deny the reality of sex is one thing which she's done, which is fine as long as you're living your life online. But we have to come back into real life to eat, drink, sleep, and to reproduce. That is all has to be done in real life. And it worries me that the detachment from that seems to be so huge and so great in some people. And no wonder the increase in you know, poor mental health and distress that individuals feel, antipathy towards society, and almost anger and a rage to other people, because we can't find fulfillment on social media. We didn't evolve for that. We evolved for something quite different. And when I look on social media across there, I see people trying to create themselves as avatars, as images, as beings on social media. And I don't think that can ever bring the fulfillment that real concrete relationships between three-dimensional human beings can recreate, because we never evolved for social media.
Now, some of what people are trying to do when they bring this into real life is they're trying to break down these, what they perceive as a kind of oppressive binary. Is there not, so that like the example that I gave of that person with like a beard and makeup, is there something liberatory in that? Is there sort of a kernel of liberation in that?
Well, it can work on social media. We don't need a sex binary on social media. But when we relate to other human beings in real life, when we walk down the street, when we go to the grocery store, when we buy fuel for the car, we're relating to other people. And when we notice those other people, we notice their bodies. Now, there are two kinds of human beings. There is male and female. And we've known that for millions of years. It goes back beyond our own species, does this? So this is baked into us, these ideas of this sex, of this binary between these two groups of people. And to try and bring the ideas of social media into real life is so utterly futile that we're going to overturn millions of years of evolution in a TikTok video, imploring everybody else change their ways. It's not realistic. It's not the law that is getting in the way of these people. It's our gut instinct. It's those ideas that go back millions of years, and it's not going to change. It's not going to change overnight. Is that so? To try and take the ideas online, this idea that you can create any avatar you like online and run with that, to try and translate that into real life, is only going to bring disappointment and a sense of futility. And I can understand, and come back to what I said before, I can understand why that is causing, I think it's contributing to an avalanche of poor mental health, especially in young people. But nobody is talking about this. Nobody is helping those people. It's no good to nod and smile and say, yes, that's nice, dear. What we need to do is to...
In part two, Debbie explains what she thinks we should do. I talk about the cross I bear with regard to my own body, the dangers of male sexuality feedback loops, and what she thinks, as someone who surgically transitioned, about recent accusations of medical malpractice in trans medicine. Visit www.patreon.com/AshleyAFrawley.